From Washington, D.C., NBC brings you America's Press Conference of the Year, Meet the Press, with today's guest, Representative Emanuel Seller, Democrat of New York, and chairman of the subcommittee that is investigating monopoly in the United States. Ready for today's unrehearsed, spontaneous press conference are four of America's top reporters. Please remember that their questions do not necessarily reveal their point of view. It's their way of getting a story for you. And now meet Mr. Ned Brooks, NBC commentator on national affairs. Mr. Lawrence Spivak, editor of the American Mercury magazine. Miss Ruth Montgomery, Washington correspondent for the New York Daily News. Mr. Warren Francis of the Los Angeles Times. And here is our guest, Representative Emanuel Seller. Finally, Miss Martha Roundtree, moderator of Meet the Press.
Before we start our press conference, I want to tell you that Meet the Press has just won one of the highest awards in television. The Institute for Education by Radio, sponsored by Ohio State University, has presented Meet the Press with a first place award. The citation reads, and I quote, "For its honesty and frankness, which makes it the most exciting press conference on the air," end of quote. Thank you, Ohio State, and all of you who have helped make this program a success. And now, Congressman Seller, if you're ready, we'll start with Mr. Francis.
Congressman Seller, before we get off into details of this monopoly investigation, I'd like to ask a very blunt question. There have been reports that your subcommittee conducting this investigation is grinding the axes for a number of companies or industrial groups who happen to be represented by your law firm. Do you care to comment on that?
Well, that is absolutely untrue, and it is a very unfair statement for anybody to make.
Thank you.
Miss Montgomery.
Well, Mr. Seller, isn't it true that although you in Congress are known as the leading prosecutor or investigator of monopoly, that your law firm represents the Atlantic and Pacific Tea Company, which is now under investigation?
That's true, but the representation of that company is in a very minor degree confined to tort cases in New York City. But I may as well express myself in this fashion now at this point. My work in Congress has nothing to do with my law office. I only play a minor part in that office. I spend most of my time in Washington, but if my clients do not care, to retain our office because of my activities in Washington, they are free to take their business elsewhere.
Go ahead, Ms. Montgomery.
Oh, Mr. Seller, a well-known columnist recently has been publishing the voting statistics on a lot of the congressmen who are known as in and outers. We call them up on the Hill the Thursday through Tuesday boys. And he claims that you are one of those who leaves on Thursdays, even though important votes may be coming up on Friday or Monday, and then comes back the following Tuesday because the congressmen along the East Coast practice law or have private investments that interest them over the weekend.
That columnist, if he would have investigated, would discover that I do not go home on Fridays, and I'm here from Monday morning early until late Friday night, and that the absences from roll call was due to my presence in the Judiciary Committee conducting these monopoly investigations.
But that always shows on the record, doesn't it? I mean, you have to get permission in order to hold hearings during the session of Congress, and that would have shown up in the congressional record had you been there.
That is true, but very frequently we do not obtain permission and we hold the hearings anyhow. We've held our hearings 5 days a week, and therefore one cannot be in two places at one time. I refuse to answer roll calls sometimes just to hear somebody make a few remarks and who may want to sound off for the purposes of his local constituents.
But that is against the reorganization plan spirit in itself, to hold those meetings without having permission from the floor. And if you aren't there, naturally it's assumed that you're out of town.
It's a rule more honored in the breach than the observance.
Mr. Spivak.
Mr. Seller, this may be a very naive question, but I've heard it said that heading a committee like yours, investigating monopoly, is quite a sweet political plum. Is that true? By plum, I mean plum for votes.
You mean patronage?
No, no, for votes. There are very few big businesses, but there are a great number of little people who have this distorted notion of bigness and monopoly.
Well, you can place any interpretation you wish upon the conduct of a monopoly investigation, but that was not my purpose in conducting an investigation. I have been elected and re-elected 14 times. I don't need this monopoly investigation to get re-elected the 15th time.
Why, for example, didn't you join up with the O'Mahony Committee and conduct one investigation instead of forcing some of these big business people down here time and time again?
I was not a member of that committee and was not appointed a member of the committee. And our purpose is quite different than the O'Mahony Committee. We are a judiciary committee. We are a legislative committee, not an investigation committee. Our purpose is primarily to see whether or not the antitrust laws are sufficient to cope with present realities. There have been so many loopholes in the antitrust laws which have been found by large businesses that it is very essential to find out what those loopholes are and how we can plug those loopholes up. That's the primary purpose of this investigation.
Well, couldn't you have found out a lot of what you wanted from the O'Mahony investigation? Was it necessary to hold your own?
I don't want to criticize the O'Mahony investigation committee, but its plan and scope and purpose is what were quite different than the plan and purpose and scope of the investigation by my judiciary committee.
Was there anything political at all in your investigation? Was there any truth in what, for example, a leading columnist said the other day, that the president urged you to continue this investigation because it would give him a great deal of political meat in
this
campaign? This
investigation has the unqualified approval of the president. I saw him only recently, and he told me to go full steam ahead, that he feels that the antitrust laws are not adequate, and we must find out how they can be made adequate.
Well, did he say, as was reported by this columnist, that this would give him a great deal of political meat on his campaign?
He did not say that to me.
Mr. Brooks.
Congressman, a great deal of your time has been devoted to the steel industry. I wonder whether you've reached any conclusions up to now as to whether the large steel company should be broken up. That's one of the purposes of your investigation.
Firstly, I want to say that here is the volumes of these hearings. These hearings were general hearings. They were conducted all last year. They were general hearings, as I said. We are now proceeding from the general to the particular. And our first particular investigation is in steel. After we finish steel, we then go into newsprint. After we finish newsprint, we will then go into whiskey. After whiskey, we have another group of industries that we will investigate.
How about
now with reference to steel? With reference to steel, I would say that one or two companies dominate the steel industry. One particular company, the United States Steel Company, is entirely too big and should be split up into component parts. The United States Steel Corporation controls about one-third of the entire ingot capacity of the United States. But that doesn't tell the whole story. A subsidiary of the United States Steel, a national tube company, is the nation's largest producer of seamless pipe and tubing, with 40% capacity. American Steel and Wire has an infrastructure of 26 plants spread all over the country, controlling 35%.
Mr. Seller?
I could go on and give you the subsidiaries of U.S. Steel, which show that they have a preponderant dominance in the various steel processing and in the finished products.
Well, they have only about one-third of the production now, as against their former figure of two-thirds. Isn't that right?
That doesn't tell the story. U.S. Steel, in addition to being a producer of steel, is the largest producer of cement. It has the largest cement-producing facilities in the world. U.S. Steel, in addition thereto, owns and operates 3,400 miles of railroads. And among those railroads are four Class A railroads, on which they make very, very substantial profits.
Well, Mr.
They also operate three steamship lines. Of course, I do hope that I'll have a chance just to finish something with reference to the magnitude of steel, so that the audience can get an idea how huge this company is.
Let's assume that it's bigger even than you think it is. Did you think it was too big during the war? And did you think it was too big immediately after the war when the president was insisting that they expand their capacities in order to produce more steel?
We need large companies and large plants in war as well as in peace. But the U.S. Steel was too large even in war. If the U.S. Steel had been broken up into its component parts, it would have produced even more steel. And its own engineers, who were retained by the U.S. Steel Corporation to evaluate the efficiency of the United States Steel Corporation, came up with a report to the effect that steel production would be in greater capacity and the production would be more efficient if United States Steel Corporation were broken up into its component parts.
Mr. Seller, may I ask you this? I think you will agree with all of us that this is the greatest industrial nation in the world. 50 years ago, steel produced 2/3 of all of our steel. Today, it produces 1/3 of our steel, and in those 50 years, isn't it true that we have grown to be one of the best industrial nations in the world and given our people more comfort?
Not because steel was reduced in size of ingot capacity, but in spite thereof, United States Steel, for example, buys out its customers. It is the largest steel drum manufacturing company in the world today. Those steel drum independents aided the American industrial advance. Steel, for example, precludes the shipment, in many instances, of suitable raw materials to many of the fabricators throughout the length and the breadth of the land, but ships that needed raw materials to its own subsidiaries, who are the competitors of the end fabricators. In other words, it becomes a competitor of its customers and finally forces those customers out of business.
What I'm saying is, haven't we grown great under our present practical system, a system that has been working? And what makes you think that your theoretical system is going to work out
better? We would have become even greater. For example, the Secretary of the Interior testified before our committee that there is not sufficient, that there would have been a greater production of steel in this country to satisfy even greater demands of steel had there been a greater decentralization of steel and not so much concentration. And today we have evidence to the effect that our economy would have been further advanced if more steel had been produced. But less steel has been produced because of the concentration and of the failure of these large steel companies to keep step with the industrial advance.
Mr. Francis.
But Mr. Seller, during the war, these large steel companies got Army, Navy, Maritime Commission, Ease for Efficiency, and various War Production Board awards. And at that time, a lot of these new Johnny-come-latelys were getting large loans and weren't ever delivering. Isn't that true?
Well, I don't know anything about your Johnny-come-latelys, but I'll say that during the war, Steel Corporation did a very good job, and I have no complaint against U.S. Steel, nor any of the U.S. Steel competitors. But that doesn't mean that modern-sized plants could not have done just as good a job, and modern-sized plants did just as good a job, because they expanded even more quickly than steel did. For example, the president of the United States Chamber of Commerce, owning the Bridgeport Brass Company, a modern-sized plant, said he readily and easily expanded his employees from 3,000 to 10,000. And that was the situation all over the country. Small plants became larger by expanding to meet the war demands. And we would have made just as much progress industrially in the war if there had been no United States Steel Corporation.
Now, you said one of the reasons that you're going into this subject is to find out about loopholes in the antitrust laws. So far, I understand most of your testimony has been from a lot of economic theorists that are saying that bigness is bad. And they haven't been talking about loopholes. If there are loopholes, why don't you get around to the legislative table?
You haven't read the testimony given. I've shown you the volumes which indicated the loopholes, and they were testified to not by starry-eyed pipsqueak philosophers or economists. They were testified to by officials of government and businessmen, men who represented industry, for example. I'll give you what we have done in that regard, if I may. For example, one of the loopholes stems from the following. It is unlawful under the Clayton Act for a large corporation to merge with a smaller corporation and thereby substantially to lessen competition in a given trade area if they acquire the stock, the corporate stock. It's unlawful. But what is the loophole? They can acquire the assets siphon off the accounts receivable and the real estate, take that over, and then they go scot-free. Now, we have already shown that we mean business and want action. We are implementing our theories, and I succeeded in getting the House to accept my bill, H.R. 2734, which will plug up that loophole. So whether the merger is by acquisition of stock or acquisition of assets, it shall be deemed unlawful.
Well, in effect,
that bill is now in the Senate and will be reported out on May 15th from the Senate Judiciary Committee and will pass the Senate in a jiffy.
Well, in effect, you're indicting the Justice Department and the Federal Trade Commission for having been negligent and not having brought this problem up before.
No, sir, that problem's been up for almost 10 years, but a recalcitrant Congress refused to pass it. The Judiciary Committee of the House passed the bill three times. It was blocked in the other body. But now I think there's a more favorable climate for the passage of the bill because of the investigations that I have undertaken and the facts that have been brought out with reference thereto.
Miss Montgomery.
Mr. Seller, the Democrats have been in control of government in this country for 18 years. How did these dreadful big monopolies that you bark about happen to develop?
There was during the war, as you know, from 40 to 45, the placing of the antitrust laws in coal storage. As a result of the conduct of the war, it was deemed advisable not to have any suits brought for violation of the antitrust laws. So for 5 years, there was no activity whatsoever. Since the cessation of hostilities, there has been considerable activity. And prior to the war, there was considerable activity. I would say that if there had been more activity, there would have been more breaking up of these large corporations, and there would have been a further advance in the industry, and our standards of living would have been even higher.
Well, isn't it true that the Democrats weren't doing a thing about it until a couple of years ago when the Republicans were in power and Senator Ferguson began calling on Attorney General Clark to do something about monopolies?
The Republicans weren't in control of the Department of Justice.
And they
haven't been in for many years. They were only in control of the Department of Justice during the regimes of Harding and Coolidge and Hoover.
That's right.
And during that period, very little was done. In comparison, I would say five or six times were the number of prosecutions brought under Democratic administrations and under Republican administrations.
Well, but you've had it for 18 years, and isn't it true that you recently called for an investigation of the soap industry, and then it was suddenly dropped when Charlie Luckman, the head of Lever Brothers, was made fundraiser for the Jefferson Jackson Day dinner?
I don't know that. I have no knowledge on that, but we're going into soap.
Well,
and I hope you develop some very important factors concerning soap. I don't care whether Mr. Luckman is or is not the head of the
industry. Well, of course he isn't now. He's off the hot seat for you again, isn't he?
Well, we can't attack every industry all at once. These investigations take months. The preparations take several months. I won't go into an investigation until I'm fully prepared. And I won't permit my staff to go into an investigation unless they're fully prepared. And that takes time.
Mr. Brooks.
Mr. Seller, do you think there are monopolies in the labor movement, the same as you say monopolies exist in business?
If you wish to call it monopoly, that is true, but labor is not a commodity. You cannot consider labor in the same category as ships or shoes or sealing wax or sacks of potatoes. And under the Norris-LaGuardia Act, Congress said that labor shall be exempt from the operations of the antitrust law.
Do you see any reason why that should be changed if a monopoly exists in labor?
I would say this. I would modify that provision called the Norris-LaGuardia Act. If labor, for example, joins with industry to create such a work stoppage as to interfere with production, as was the case recently with a three-day week work stoppage where there was a conspiracy between labor and capital, I would say that the law should be changed to meet that situation.
Well, CIO and the AFL are now talking about consolidating. Would you consider that to be an unhealthy consolidation?
No, I would think that's a healthy consolidation. Again, labor is not a commodity and must be looked upon differently. The work of human hands and human brains is not the same as this glass or that tablecloth or the table. It's quite different.
Well, they're exempt from the Antitrust Act, and I've heard it said by some of your colleagues in Congress that in the last 10 years or more, there has not been an antitrust case won by the government in which the public has had any substantial benefit. Is that true?
Oh, that is utterly fallacious. I think The recent case brought against a General Electric company, two cases brought against a General Electric company, one in New York and one in New Jersey, where Judge Foreman in the latter case and Judge John Knox in the former in the other case excoriated the General Electric company for their bad practices, caused a cessation of those bad practices referenced to incandescent lamps.
Did it bring down prices?
Yes, sir.
Now, Mr. Spivak.
Mr. Sella, what I'd like to get from you is this. Do you think bigness in itself is bad?
I would put it this way. I don't want to set a standard where bigness would in and of itself be bad. There are certain types of bigness that must be attacked, which is a legitimate area for inquiry. And those big types of business, where they become overdeveloped so that they lose in efficiency, and they stifle competition, which is the very life of trade, the competition which build up our country, those companies must be truncated and divorced from non-essential, non-allied activities.
Well, Mr. Seller, isn't it true...
And I'd be glad to explain that further if you wish.
After the broadcast. Mr. Seller, isn't it true that growth is hard to regulate, that it's easy to run as fast as one can, but almost impossible to run as slow as one can without actually stopping?
I don't want to have these companies run slow. We've had lots of experience with controlling growth. For example, the same arguments that this distinguished array of members of the Fourth Estate is developing now was offered against the Public Utility Holding Company Act when we had the Commonwealth and Southern and the Insular Empire. And what did Congress do? They segregated numbers of these public utility holding companies. They forced them to become independent companies, broke up the holding companies because they were too large and they were charging too much for electric, light, and gas.
But isn't it true that those holding companies were holding companies and weren't making any contribution? They were stock-controlling companies.
That's exactly what U.S. Steel Corporation is, a holding company now. That's exactly what the Shenley Distilling Company is, a holding company. That's what the DuPont Empire is, a holding company, which not only holds DuPont, but owns a stockholding interest in General Motors to the extent of over 22%. DuPont owns the controlling interest of United States Rubber, has a stock controlling interest in Liberty Ford's Owen Glass. That's a holding company. It's not necessary for DuPont's to make good cellophane and efficiently make all its other products and at the same time hold all this vast amount of stock in General Motors, U.S. Rubber, and Liberty Ford Owen Glass. That's a holding company.
Just how has the public suffered? Because DuPont, for example, has had a large ownership in General Motors. Ford, for example, has operated as an independent. And yet General Motors has always met competition, hasn't it?
Power of that side is dangerous.
You just as worried about power?
Worried about power. We cannot leave power that sort to chance. It may be that the gentlemen who have that power are benevolent despots now, but they may become malevolent despots. It's very essential for the nascent nation to watch, look, and listen to see what those men in those dominant positions are doing.
Well, I'm glad to hear you say that, Mr. Sella, but aren't you afraid of this great growth of power of the government, which steps in and begins to run these businesses as well as government itself?
Nobody said that we want the government to run business. I didn't say that. I want the government to keep its nose out of business. I don't want the government to regulate any business.
Well,
I want competition to prevail.
Well, how powerful is the steel company, for example, today, when every time you or any other committee sends for them, they have to come down and be subjected to investigation and often to harassment?
Because they have offended against the law.
No, but how powerful can a company like that be when at the snap of your finger they have to obey orders?
That company has been so baneful in its effects upon our industry that we have to bring them down. There's no competition in the steel industry.
That is my question. My question
is,
isn't your investigating committee so much more powerful than that company when you can snap your fingers and get them to come and listen to your beck and call?
Thank you very much for the compliment.
Isn't that true?
I didn't know I had that power, I assure you.
Well, any time you say Mr. Fairless come down, he comes down, doesn't he?
Well, he comes down because he feels it's probably good public relations for him to come down and express himself the way he does. But you said about power in government. I don't want the government to become so powerful, but the government has to become powerful to be able to get after powerful companies. But I want to repeat with all the force within me, I'm opposed to government regulation. I'm opposed to Mr. Senator O'Mahony's idea of a publication of a price rise for 30 days. I feel the government has no right to interfere in that regard. I don't want a public utility aspect to be applied to these businesses. I want competition restored. Mr. Fallis and the others said they give support to competition, but it's the support that the rope gives to the hanged. That's no support.
When does business get big, Congressman Sell? I mean, how can you prove that business is big?
Business gets big when it becomes all-powerful and has within itself the power to stifle competition and to elbow all competitors off the sidewalk.
But how do you it's prove
like,
that,
Phil? I would apply this standard, like what the elephant said. The elephant said, every man for himself as he danced amongst the chickens. I want the chickens to have a chance
Mr.
for that one as well
Seller,
as the elephant.
Isn't government
That's what I
becoming,
mean by big.
Mr.
Bigness.
Seller, isn't the government becoming that elephant today, though? And aren't businesses the chickens that you worry so much about?
Not at all. Not at all. It is government only becomes big because of these big businesses. In other words, government follows in bigness to get after them. It doesn't precede.
Miss Montgomery.
Mr. Seller, how can you have it both ways? Now, how can you say that this is too big and the government has just said, for instance, that the A&P tea company is too big, that it must be broken down, and yet how can you ethically derive money from having your law firm go into court and support A&P and say that it's all right when the government says it isn't, and then you prosecute some other big firm that you say is too big up on
well,
Capitol
that's
Hill.
Proof of the fact that what I'm doing here, I'm doing regardless of any clients in my office. And if they don't like what I do with reference to this monopoly, they can go elsewhere.
Well, is it true that your law firm also represents a large segment of the movie industry which could profit by your prosecution of Warner Brothers?
That isn't true. We do not represent a large segment. We represent some small theaters.
Well,
we don't represent anything. We don't have nothing to do whatsoever in our representation with a motion, with the production of motion pictures.
But those small theaters are the ones that you say in your investigation are being hurt by Warner Brothers' monopoly on the big
theater. I never said a word. I haven't expressed myself in that regard at all. I didn't have to, because Warner Brothers and Paramount and Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer have had suits brought against them where they were been compelled in the main to separate their various component parts and to operate independently. I didn't have to say it. The government did that.
Our time's getting awfully short, Mr. Frank.
One quick one, Mr. Seller. You were going to go into the aviation industry. Is your law firm representing any of these non-scheduled airlines or any of these groups of applicants for franchises before the CAB?
None whatsoever. I'm amazed that you members of the Fourth Estate would ask questions like this. You could examine the situation very well without parading this before the television public in this fashion. I can assure you that oil don't mix with water, and I will not even attempt to have oil mixed with water. I want to say uninhibitedly that my conduct of this investigation has nothing whatsoever to do with my law office.
I have to interrupt. Thank you for this press conference. In just a moment, we'll learn who our guest will be next week.
Next Sunday afternoon, NBC Television will again present America's Press Conference of the Air, Meet the Press, 1/2 hour later. Be sure to join us then, when our guest will be Senator Edwin Johnson of Colorado, two-fisted senator whose interest as head of the Interstate Commerce Commission has ranged from the Ingrid Bergman affair to color television. And now, good afternoon for Mr. Ned Brooks, Mr. Lawrence Spivak, Miss Ruth Montgomery, Mr. Warren Francis, Miss Martha Roundtree, Representative Emanuel Seller. Meet the Press has come to you from the Capitol Room of the Wardman Park Hotel in Washington, D.C., one of America's great hotels.